Look up there in the sky. It's a bird, a plane. It's Handsome Boys Comics Hour.
Those boys are so handsome.
One artist.
One weekly discussion of comics and nerd culture. I am your host, Robbie Dorman, literature geek and writer.
And I'm your other host, Eric Z. Goodnight, professional artist and illustration nerd.
And we are the Handsome Boys Comics Hour, your home for news, reviews, slightly antagonistic banter, and much, much more. How you guys doing? Doing good out there, Radio Land?
I'm sure they are. You know, I think we need to stop and recut that intro in falsettos.
I don't think we need to do that.
I think we need to do it always.
I'm not doing a whole broadcast in falsetto.
No, just the intro.
I'm not doing an intro in falsetto.
That's your loss, brother.
How are you doing, Eric? How are you?
I'm doing pretty well. I'm really bored, so...
You look like Guile now.
I do. I don't know that, actually, I don't think that I do. I don't have a brush on my head.
I guess that's fair.
I can't paint a mural with my hair. I do have a Marine's haircut and no hair on my face right now. It's weird. It's really fucking weird.
I've had Semper Fi, I do or die. Ooh,
gung-ho.
Ooh,
yeah, gung-ho, gung-ho, gung-ho.
Yeah.
We've already done that joke on the phone.
We have, and now we have it. Recorded in perpetuity.
Mm-hmm.
That's very important.
It is very important. It's the most importantest thing.
Yeah. So, folks, we have a very good episode for you. Because they're all very good.
Well, this one's extra very good.
Yeah. We got more Wolverine and Dying.
Mm-hmm.
We got lots of Marvels.
Lots of Marvels. And the Missy
and the
variety.
Miss variety. And for book club this week, we are reading The Wrenchies by Farrell Dalrymple.
That is a funny name.
That's a good name.
That's an Oompa Loompa's name.
It kind of is.
That's a Smurf's name.
It matches his aesthetic.
It does. It kind of does.
Yeah, so it works out. But before we get into either of those things, we are going to jump in, checking in.
Did you hear that noise? I sure did.
Yeah, that noise was great.
Yeah, it was the noisiest.
Checking in is the segment where Eric and I talk about what we've been up to during the week. I'm going to go first, because Eric went first last time.
And almost all the time, because you're like, just do things, Eric. Yeah. Entertain me.
I've got, as is my way, I'm checking in with a six-month-old video game.
And not a board game from 6 months ago?
Not a board game.
Actually, I think if you're playing a six-month-old board game, you're kind of cutting edge, aren't you?
That's pretty new, yeah. If you get a board game within the first 6 months of it being released, that's actually on the breaking news.
But if you play a six-month-old video game, you might as well be an octogenarian.
Yeah, I'm an old
What's
man.
Up with that?
Yeah. I played Batman Arkham Origins, which is the third game in the Batman Arkham series. Not created by Rocksteady Games, though. Rocksteady made both Arkham Asylum and Arkham City. This was not made by them. A lot of people gave it a lot of flack when it came out. They said they didn't like it nearly as much as those two. Frankly, I don't understand that. Because I think it's just... I don't think it's as good as Arkham Asylum. But it's as good or better than City. I don't think it has as much content as City, but it's just as tight a game. Arkham, have you played any of these games, Eric?
I have not played even the first one, but I've heard a lot of very good and interesting things about them, and I would give them a try. Probably they're all available for my PC, correct?
I played this on Steam, so yeah.
Yeah, I'm into Batman on my computer machine.
I would say start with Asylum and then progress if you like the game after of it. Yeah. Asylum is the best of them. It's the first. It's the tightest experience. It's all in Arkham Asylum.
Okay. Well, cool.
Arkham City takes place in the entire city. Origins is a prequel to both of those games. This takes place. They don't really adhere strictly to comic book continuity or even movie continuity. They're kind of like a mix of everything.
It's kind of their own continuity, which is kind of what I would expect from a video game, and it's honestly what they should do.
Yeah, or this is sort of pseudo after what, like Long Halloween or Dark Victory. Mm-hmm. It's like in the early Batman era kind of thing after year one, and he's kind of making his way, but he meets the Joker. You see them fight the Joker for the first time. The base premise is that Black Mask has hired an assortment of assassins to take out Batman all on Christmas Eve night. And so you're fighting, Deathstroke and Deadshot and Bane and Copperhead, and they renamed the KG Beast into the Electrocutioner.
That's a really retarded.
Yeah, it really.
Thank
is
you,
DC.
Switch. That makes that's perfect. That makes that's exactly.
It's even
what
a worse
I
name. I mean, KG Beast is so bad that it's good. Electrocutioner, I don't think it makes it to there. But
it sounds like a bench warming wrestler. So I'm the Electrocutioner.
It kind of it's not good. You do get his electric gauntlets, and that's cool. The game, it's very similar gameplay. It mixes between, kind of squad combat. Like, you take on, 12 guys at once. And then you have, stealth sequences where you, basically take people out from the shadows with all your gadgets. I liked it a lot. I don't think it's any... People, I don't know why they're criticizing it when it first came out.
Because
I would definitely
suggest it. People are dumber than hell.
I am looking forward to the next Arkham game, Arkham Knight, but that got pushed back till next summer, unfortunately.
Well, that sounds fine to me.
Yeah, Arkham Origins, if you haven't checked it out, you've been waiting on it, it's been on my list for a while. It was cheap on Steam, so I got it. It's good. It's fun.
It's the funnest.
The other thing I want to check in with is wrestling.
Wrestling.
Eric mentioned professional wrestling, so I did. I'm gonna check in with some professional wrestling. Yeah, it's NXT's most recent pay per view is NXT Takeover, Fatal 4-Way, but it's just the second one, and NXT Takeover number 2. NXT, for those who do not know, is basically like the WWE's farm system. It's where they have all their it's their developmental system.
It's where they get all their little wrestler cabbage patch kids.
They basically all their guys, all the people they're training, and all the indie people that they sign all go there first to kind of learn the WWE style, to kind of get in, like, find a gimmick. Sometimes it just depends, but frankly, it's better than WWE most of the time because the wrestlers have more time to wrestle. There's less dumb storylines with no real purpose. Like, everything there has a purpose of some sort. And you get to see these guys be a little looser. I think that's a part of it, too. The match at to end the event was a fatal four-way between Tyler Breeze, who is basically Zoolander if he was a wrestler.
That's wonderful.
Yeah. Tyson Kidd, who is the husband of a female wrestler and is most famously known as her husband. He's the heel. He's a heel, and so they call him. They just basically, but they make fun of him. There's Tyler. There's Sami Zayn and Adrian Neville, and both of those guys were very famous in the indie scenes. Adrian Neville is I'm fairly convinced that if he wasn't a professional wrestler, he'd be like an Olympian gymnast. Because he's that talented and that acrobatic. Sami Zayn used to be a guy in the indie scene named El Generico.
Well,
he was the generic luchador, but now he took off his mask for NXT, and now he's known online as the Hot Barista.
These guys are really They're not afraid to try things.
No, that's the beauty of NXT. It doesn't. It's not afraid to kind of embrace the goofier side of wrestling. It's allowed. It's fun. It's fun. So if you like wrestling, this is exclusively on the WWE Network. It's $9.99 a month. If you watch wrestling at all, you know that because they have been banging into your head for the past like 2 months. But it's certainly that price is certainly worth it just for the pay per views and NXT alone, not alone the tape library. But go check out NXT TakeOver 2. It's a lot of fun. Eric, what have you been up to this week? What million things have you been doing? What bazillion things have you been doing?
I have been consuming so much media, it's insane. And I'm going to try and talk about some of it as quickly as I can. Yesterday, I met up with some mutual friends of ours, and we went to Maker Faire Orlando. And it was a really fun experience. I met a lot of old friends from the Tampa Makerspace and talked to them. One of the guys that I had a long conversation with when I was volunteering told me about how he's making a satellite that he's going to launch into space.
Of course. And that's what you do.
Well, I mean, he's showing me like all of this stuff that's all readily available. And he's basically showed me I don't know. There are no words. He's like, yeah, this is going to be like a plasma engine, and this is why you have to have your packets look like this in space. And like, he's explaining all this stuff to him. I'm like, dude, you're fucking amazing. Like, none of the stuff that he was doing seemed all of that technical. He wasn't necessarily trying to wow me with technical wizardry as much as like how incredibly clever it is that he's basically taking consumer level, like garbage, like electronic boards. And it's like, here's how you can put this in space and I'm going to do it. I was so impressed. And there were so many incredibly cool people there. Like I could literally I could probably talk about each one of them and fill up this whole podcast, but I won't do it. But this is the Maker Faire sponsored by Make Magazine. And all kinds of rad people, like, you know, Mark Frauenfelder, who, you know, he's like the founder and the editor of it. Or I actually don't think he's the founder, but, you know, I kind of hoped I would have ran into him. But anyway, it was a really great experience. It cost me like $19 or something to get in. And I spent probably 5 hours there just talking to people and there are, you know, artists and craftspeople there as well, not just engineers. But
yeah, there's
very good experience.
A friend of mine on Facebook was working the event. He was posting pictures. Looked very cool.
Who was he? Was he at a table or was he just a volunteer?
I volunteer. You okay. Met him. You met him at Bacon, that Bacon Fest thing we went to.
Germaine. Okay. Okay. So Bacon Germaine was at the event.
I more closely associate him with his roller derby stuff. He works a lot of roller derby events as well.
That seems like a good thing for someone who, that seems like a good idea. I wonder, they take open volunteers. It seems that excites me.
Well, he officiates.
Yes, of course.
Yeah.
They
probably, they'll probably teach you, and they probably would take open volunteers. From what I understand, they are in constant need of people like that.
Well, that's exciting. Anyway, if there is a Maker Faire in your area, I suggest that you go, because this one was a blast. It was at the Orlando Science Center, inexplicably. And it was really difficult to tell, like, people that just had their table and they're doing their own display. It was hard to tell them apart from the displays in the museum, you know? Although sometimes it worked in their favor. Like there was a big artist room that was in a room full of dinosaur bones. And that was kind of cool. But most of the time it was just really confusing. I think it was last week I checked in with a great podcast. It's called You Are Not So Smart.
Yes.
And it's about pop psychology and the ways that we delude ourselves. And that has led me to get from Audible both of his audiobooks. And right now I am a little more than halfway through with You Are Not So Smart, and I'm going to follow it up with his second book, You Are Now Less Dumb. And, I mean, it's really the same thing, just more the same. I think I actually like his podcast more, which is odd that the free content is, it seems like this is kind of the case, is the free content is often better. People will give away something good for free, and it's, I don't know. There's almost no reward other than feeling like you're a nice guy for supporting somebody. But I think You Are Not So Smart was on sale, still is on sale at Audible for $5. And I got You Are Now Less Dumb for a credit. So I would recommend it so far. It's a very good read. And gonna check in with one last thing because it is
one last thing.
But yeah, it has been all consuming. I'm gonna try and be really brief about it. You know, we talked about when we read Dragon Ball that they've done a recut version of the original Dragon Ball Z.
Mm-hmm.
Responding to the complaints of, you know, the dubs and translations are bad. It's censored. It drags on for too long and it's full of too much filler. Well, the original animation company is Toei. They have recut it for, I think, initially for a Japanese audience and then again for an American audience. And I have started watching it. I'm about 20 episodes deep. And I want to say that 20 episodes of Kai are probably about 60-plus episodes of the regular show. Like, I'm actually shocked at how fast-paced it is, and it's actually much more watchable. And it's very charming and very nostalgic to watch these old Dragon Ball episodes. And I just loved it so much when I was a kid. It's just really, really fun stuff to see it again. It's still deeply, deeply flawed, and I think that, you know, how we talked about the sexism of Dragon Ball,
mm-hmm.
It's something that never even occurred to me, but it's like such a boy's story. It's such a male-centered story. In this part that I'm in now, they go to Piccolo's homeworld, and they find out that the race that lives there are no women. Like, they're an entirely, quote-unquote, genderless race, and they're all men. They're all men. They reproduce asexually. So this whole segment, there are literally no females. It's all male characters.
Do they lay eggs?
They do. They lay eggs out of their mouth. That's what...
Are you serious?
I am dead serious. That's how Piccolo from Dragon Ball was born, is Goku punched a hole in his dad, and he puked an egg out of his mouth. That's how Piccolo was born. Piccolo is like 2 years older than Gohan.
Okay.
Do you know who Gohan is?
No.
Do you know who Piccolo is?
No.
How do you not know who these people are?
I never watched all this stuff.
Do you know who the green guy in the turban is?
No.
You've never seen a picture of that.
I'm sure I've seen it, but it doesn't ever, like...
Well, that's fine. At the beginning of the story, Piccolo is like a six-year-old, and he is, yeah, it's very entertaining.
Okay. I think we're good on checking in. But with that, we will move over to the floppiest part of the week. You know what part of the week that is?
Actually, I don't. Why don't you tell me?
It's Weekly Floppies.
Ooh.
Weekly Floppies is the part of the show where Eric and I read the week's books and tell you to buy or do not buy them. It's a very binary system. Mm-hmm. Unless we are kind of meh on it, and then it gets kind of squishy in the middle.
Did you see the missed opportunity for a pun there? The binary system?
I didn't realize.
I know.
I just didn't think about it.
That's why you're dumb.
That's why I'm dumb, because I don't think of every pun that's ever existed.
That's right. You are now less dumb.
That's what I do. We're going to start off. It's a little strange week this week, because there's no DC books.
There were no DC books. DC they're on vacation.
There's precisely one. Well, it's they're doing Future's End all month long, so it's kind of is like we're on vacation from DC because I have zero interest in reading any Future's End books. There's one book that wasn't of Superman Unchained that I thought was interesting, but there was a glut of interesting indie books this week, plus our usual spate of Marvel books. So, sorry, no DC this week.
It is a shame that we don't get to read some really bad DC books. I'm crestfallen.
This fall, we're gonna start off this week with Death of Wolverine number 2, written by Charles Soule, pencils by Stephen Niven, inks by Jay Leeston, Justin Ponser doing the colors, and Chris Alopoulos on the letters.
Chris the Greek.
This is basically seeing Wolverine try and track down why Viper in Madripoor wants him. And apparently it goes deeper than her. I was not as impressed with this issue as I was the first one.
I still had a good time reading it, but the first one was very good, particularly that we were coming off of a very average to poor Wolverine story. The first one was very strong. This one just sort of falls back into the same old rehash territory of same old Wolverine villains and same old scenarios. We do have the benefit of Hangover Wolverine in this book.
I really, really like Hangover Wolverine.
He really looks why can't I think of the name Zach Galifianakis? He looks just like Zach Galifianakis.
If Zach Galifianakis was more badass than he is.
I guess so. He's karate Zach Galifianakis.
Yeah, there we go.
So he's doing karate.
He is doing karate.
Karate!
Some martial arts.
Yep. The hairiest Sabretooth ever.
I think Sabretooth should always be that hairy.
Yeah.
I like him. I think that's what Sabretooth works the best.
He looks like the lead singer of Amon Amarth.
And I think that's appropriate.
Yeah, I think it is. Well, I'm sure there's some overlap of guys that like Amon Amarth and guys that like Sabretooth.
Probably, yeah.
And maybe even guys that are in Amon Amarth.
And guys that are Sabretooth?
Well, maybe. You don't know.
I don't know. We also get Lady Deathstrike appearance, and even some. We get some Kitty Pride. I like Kitty Pride. No, I guess Wolverine doesn't have an eye.
Yeah,
forever.
He's gonna be dead soon, so it doesn't matter.
That's fair.
They can hack off all kinds of bits of him.
Steve McNiven's art still looks really great.
Yeah, it's surprisingly simple in a lot of ways. Still is a very nice looking book, though. It, for some reason, it doesn't excite me all that much. But
the
it's art still
of the book in general.
Well, the art is specifically what I'm talking about now.
Okay,
but it's still very good. I don't think it's McNiven at his best, at its McNiveniest. But it's still serviceable. It's still good. It doesn't excite me. What was it? Was it Uncanny Avengers he was doing? That was some amazing work right there. That
it
is
very good.
Yeah, he was doing that. That was an excellent book. It bothers me because it's just sort of it's up to his par, but it's just sort of par, if you know what I mean. It's not dynamic and intense enough for me to be really terribly impressed by it, but it is very good McNiven work. If that makes sense at all. It doesn't really hold it back, but it also isn't the incredible work that you expect out of him at this point.
I'm not as enthusiastic a buy as I was last week. I'm still a buy. It's still good. I mean, it's leading the story and it's moving it forward. It's not stationary or anything. It's just kind of it's hard to do a quote-unquote Death of Wolverine story and not include Sabretooth in it somewhere. So I understand it.
I think I feel pretty similarly that it is less exciting. It's by no means bad. I'm still very interested to see where the event is going to go. So I'm all in.
Call. You got three aces. What do you got?
I'm not sure what you mean.
Poker metaphor. You're all in. I got three aces.
Okay. I have 22 aces.
That doesn't work in poker.
No, that's... I'm afraid you don't understand.
That means you're cheating, and that you're going to get kicked out of the casino.
So you're a casino now?
I am. Licensed.
Okay. Well, that's fine.
Bruno, get him.
Bruno?
It's one of my bouncers. One of my bodyguards.
I was going to say, is it one of your cats?
No, not yet.
You seem like the kind of person that would have a cat named Bruno.
I would not have a cat named Bruno. That's not a cat name.
That's a good cat name.
No, it's a dog name.
I think that's why it's a good cat name. That's ironic.
I don't know about that.
It's like naming a cat Danger Mouse.
Danger Mouse is an excellent name for a cat. Thank you very much.
I think only an idiot would name a cat Danger Mouse.
Well, you're an idiot.
You're a double idiot.
Your face is an idiot.
Okay. You're right. It's got no beard on it. It's really weird.
Now Danger
wants to cat around.
She does.
See if you can get her to meow into the microphone.
She doesn't meow whenever she's happy.
Jesus Christ. Stupid.
She's reaching my face.
It's really funny.
That was Death of Wolverine number 2. Death of Wolverine number 2. We are a double bye.
Yes.
Next up is Captain Marvel number 7, written by Kelly Sue DeConnick, art by Marcio Takara, Lee Loveridge on colors, Joe Caramagna doing the letters. I am biased about this issue. We just came off Cat Talk. We just came off Cat Talk. A lot of this issue is involving Carol dealing with Rocket Raccoon thinking her cat is an alien that lays eggs.
Mm-hmm.
And then they are attacked by these aliens. And they find her cat among a room full with alien eggs. Hi, Danger.
Cat is being really adorable.
It really is. Like, it's hard not to.
She's like biting your hair now.
She likes to do that. She's cute.
Now you're headbutting her.
I am. She likes that.
This is a dumb interaction.
What are you doing, Danger?
She's trying to take your mustache off. She's gonna wear your mustache.
Lay down again. Lay down. There you go. But this issue. It starts off with a very serious tone, but it's generally a pretty silly issue, and I like it a lot. That the panel with the cat laying on all the eggs. I want to get that framed.
It seems like something you'd be very impressed with.
It's so, yeah, self-satisfied cat among all these alien eggs. How do you feel about this issue, Eric?
Honestly, it feels a little indulgent. I like Captain Marvel. I like the way this is written. I think of all the Captain Marvels that we've picked up, this is the most... You could easily ignore this one, and nothing would come of it. It looks very nice. I love the way the dialogue's written. I love the way the character's handled. I don't need to read this, though.
You don't need to read about alien kitty cats?
No, I do not. I will be fine without it. And honestly, I don't know. Honestly, I just sort of want to see where it's going. This feels like an editorial delay, almost. I don't know. I've fallen out of the storyline, and I'm not as invested. Have you been following it?
Yeah, I read every single one. This is not connected to anything. This is just her. This is just kind of an interlude, I think, between whatever. But I like it. I think it's fun.
Right, and I think that
it's not important in the quote unquote
exactly. And I think there's a place for that. It's still it's still a solid issue, but I could easily pass on it.
It's because you don't have a heart, Eric.
What's your point? Some of us, we pump blood with bicycle pumps.
I'm just saying that you need to have a heart to feel connected to the little kitty cat.
That's the gayest thing anyone's ever said on a podcast.
I don't think it is, honestly, but you gotta, I'm connected to the kitty cat.
I'm sure there are just gigabytes of podcasts about gay sex, and that's the gayest thing that's ever been said. Ever.
You insulting me with your homophobic slurs doesn't detract from this issue. I love it. I am a solid buy on Captain Marvel number 7. All you cat people, all my cat people out there.
All your cat peeps.
And this also has like a little bit of alien in it, which I think is a clear influence, but it's a very silly. It's kind of, it's not taking itself seriously, and I like it a lot. So I'm a buy.
I am not a buy, but I'm not, I don't.
Get out.
Did air just leak out of you?
Get out.
Leave. Okay.
Okay, well.
This is going to be a really one-sided podcast.
Eric lost his heart. His heart's, we have to do a Grinch operation on him.
Wow. A Grinch operation.
Yeah, a Grinch operation.
Seem to be moving your filter there a little bit.
I am trying. The cat. There was some cat interference with it.
Well,
next up, Eric, we're gonna. Captain Marvel was a buy for me. Eric has no soul. Next up is Miss Marvel number 8. We'll see if Eric buys this. Well, it's a true test.
You know I'm a buy for this. I don't even have to tell you anything about it.
Also, I don't know that, Eric. After you buy Captain Marvel number 7, I don't know if you're gonna like Miss Marvel number 8. It also concerns heavily an animal. Kind of silly adventure that's not quote unquote important.
It's Miss Marvel. And you can talk over me all you want.
That's what I'm trying to do. I can just edit you out entirely, and it'll make me sound less like I'm talking to myself.
You're a terrible person, Norman.
Written by G. Willow Wilson, art by Adrian Alfana, Ian Herring doing colors, Joe Caermagna doing the letters. This is seeing Kamala bring in Lockjaw as her new pet. The issue really is really fun because it starts off with like a perspective from, you get basically a POV from Lockjaw, and everyone's very alarmed.
He's a very weird looking animal.
Well, yes, he is. Hello, my name is Lockjaw. I like hugs.
Naturally.
Very adorable.
It's a dog with a mustache. It's really strange.
It does have a mustache.
Yeah. Dog stash.
She fights a robot. Things happen. They attack the school. The robot has Wi-Fi.
It's really good to see Adrian Alfana back on art. I enjoyed the last book. He really brings it all together. I do think that G. Willow Wilson has been consistently good across all these issues. I kind of hope she writes this forever, but this is good old fashioned Kamala Khan, Miss Marvel. I'm so happy that the team is back together.
I like the robot has free Wi-Fi.
I mean, yeah. How else is it going to steal your data?
Yeah, and I am defiantly pro Lockjaw as well. I would think we just do this every time Miss Marvel comes out. Where we just go, oh, this is really good. You should buy this.
Yeah, there's really not a whole lot to say about it. Just you need to buy it. It does look really weird. Like, I'm looking at one of the last pages where Kamala's teacher looks like she's just, like, powering through a wall. I'm not exactly sure what's going on, but the teacher's just like, and
I think she's, like, trying to shield people and...
I know, but it's
debris or whatever.
She's
inhuman.
She probably is.
She's secretly trying to help Kamala out.
Mm-hmm. She's all that Terra Genesis. You know how it is.
I do know how it is because I'm inhuman too.
You're so not.
But
your power is to turn into jelly around cats.
That's fair. Miss Marvel number 8. I am a buy.
Yeah, God, buy this book.
I will buy this book.
I do think that I kind of want to see some... I would kind of like to see the stories take some slightly different shapes. How do you feel on that?
No, I mean, it's progressing, it's moving.
Yeah, it's not terrible.
Oh, God. Another cat attack. I think there's enough progression issue that it's, and that her as a character is fun enough that I don't really care if it's not ever taking on anything big. It will eventually probably get there. She is really, literally, this is her first enemy. So,
yes.
I think that they should, that investing some time into building up, like, if she is going to be a long-term character in the Marvel Universe, and like, creating a long-lasting archenemy is very important as well. So I think, you know.
I definitely like that. I just feel that because they are focusing on building that, it feels... Lockjaw is a nice addition to it, but she feels disjointed from the rest of the Marvel Universe. And I would like to see... I would like to see her show up more. And in different ways, and I would like to see stories start to take different shapes. But that being said... I would not complain if it was just this for a very long time.
So, double buy, Ms. Marvel number 8.
Yeah, double buy it again.
That's a
quadruple buy.
Quadruple buy. Next up, we're going to delve into our trio of indie books. All number ones. They're all three books, all kind of very different. Copperhead number 1 is what we're starting off with. Written by Jay Farber. Art by Scott Godlewski, colors by Ron Riley, Thomas Maurer doing the letters. This is just, you know, sci-fi western, another take on that. We're watching a female sheriff kind of go to this desert frontier planet, and she's moving with her son, meeting the deputy, her deputy. And dealing with a little bit of some of the problems of her city, I guess you want to call it, town. It isn't, I would say it's not, it's, I think the guy, like, did you read the Aftermatter, Eric?
I don't remember if I did. I don't think that I did. I might have just sort of grazed over it real quick and just got in and out.
Yeah, it's... the first thing he says, I'm not the first person to think of this.
Yeah, I do remember that exact phrase.
And I think that this is not, like, if you described it just like an elevator pitch to someone, necessarily I don't think it might sell it. But I think that there's enough character in it.
Oh, yeah.
That it makes it worthwhile. There's the kind of the sci-fi western is a thing that's been done a lot. But there's a lot of interesting things in it. The lead character is very interesting. I really like all the main characters we've been introduced so far, all are interesting enough, and there's enough
meat to all of them.
Yeah, that it makes it more than just what the basic pitch is.
One of the things that I think this has done very well is there's a lot of times when they have to introduce this lead female character. Like, it feels like a put-on that they're like, well, I just want to put a woman here. And then it feels like a put-on that she's going to be this strong female character. She's going to kick a lot of ass. You know, that it's that misunderstanding of strong female character. She manages to be, I think, a genuine... strong female character, even though we don't know enough about her really to establish that, she still feels like an interesting and flawed real person. She still manages to be a very tough sort of character that suits the role that she's in. And it's not done very heavy-handedly. It's done with a pretty light touch. So I think it's very strong in that light.
And it limits a lot of number one issues fall into is a lot of exposition.
Yes,
this shows and doesn't tell.
It does a very excellent job of that. It's it tells the story incredibly well. There are very few times where those sort of brush strokes, I don't know, I feel like I could spin my wheels on this all day, but it's surprisingly well done. It's nice and it's interesting. Some of the character designs and some of the panels are worse off than others. Particularly, I think there are some that were just phoned in at the end of the, not quite the last pages, but I would say about three or four in from that. They feel a little weaker than others, but it's pretty strong. And I think that it could be a good look for this going forward. I think that particularly as they go on and they develop these characters, it's going to really develop into something really special. This is one to watch.
Yeah, it's very good. It's a lot of fun.
Oh, absolutely. I feel really good about this book. I do think it's weird that there are like aliens here that are clearly from Monsters Incorporated.
Well, it's a crossover. Pixar space western.
But yeah,
next we're gonna see one of the cars from Cars.
I mean, certainly. I mean, that's a really weird alien, right? It's like a plane
Pixar,
with eyeballs.
If Pixar isn't even already working on spaceships or something, I bet they will be. They've done Cars. They've done planes. What's left? Boats.
I think I'm gonna vomit.
But we're a double buy on Copperhead number one. Enthusiastic. It's a very good first issue.
I am not a buy on Pixar's boats.
Not yet.
No, I'm a triple do not buy. By myself.
You've done it.
Yeah.
Three times. Put forth yep. Next up is Wild's End number one, created by Dan Abnett and I.N.J. Colbard, written by Dan Abnett, illustrated and lettered by I.N.J. Colbard. That is quite. There's three initials before you get to a name. I.N.J. Colbard. Is that part of his personality profile?
He's an I.N.F.J.
Yes. Yeah. I mean, I.N.J. Colbard did all the art. This is basically like War of the Worlds, kind of crossed with like. Why can't I think of the name of that? Rabbits.
Winnie the Pooh.
No, not Winnie the Pooh. Winnie the
it's
Pooh.
A lot
some,
like
there
Winnie,
is,
it is a
there
lot
is
Winnie
like
the Winnie
Pooh
the Pooh
in here.
Pooh.
Yeah,
it is a
but
lot.
But I was
like
thinking
Winnie
more of the rabbit.
You were thinking
story.
Of Watership Down.
Watership Down. I don't know if anyone is familiar. I don't know if you're familiar with this here. Brian Jacques. If you've ever heard of him? He wrote a lot. I was a big fan when I was a kid. He wrote a lot of kind of idyllic, kind of fantasy with all. Animal all, casts.
All animal characters.
There's no humans.
Anthropomorphic animals.
Yeah, exactly. But this is basically set in, I would say, post-World War I.
It's like Edwardian.
Era. Yeah.
It's Edwardian England.
And we're just this little tiny village.
Yeah, it's like it's a northern England country village.
And there's this new a dog, a hound. Who's a veteran of armed forces, who's experienced some stuff, and he's kind of our window, I would say, into the new setting. But then aliens land, robots, whatever, and fry.
They fry some pork.
They fry a pig lady. It's actually pretty horrific.
It is. It really shocked me.
Yeah, because the rest of this
it's very
comic
cuddly.
Is, yeah, it's very, like, kind of soft, and
yes.
You don't know what to get, and then it's kind of this ghastly violence when she's enveloped in flame.
And honestly, I think if something that violent was in, like, Infinity or something, you wouldn't even bat an eye. But because the rest of this is so cuddly,
yeah,
you don't even think... You don't see it coming, and you're just like, "Ooh!"
You're like, "Oh my, the pig lady!
Oh my god! Now she's a rack of ribs."
That poor pig lady. But I really like this. I think it again. I think I like Copperhead. This kind of weird mashup of genres. It's more than what it seems.
Mm.
Like, I like the dialogue manages this to be like sound British without being so obnoxious.
Yeah, it's not obnoxious, but I think, I mean, it sounds like country British people. Like, I could hear it so clearly in my head.
Right.
Not that I'm necessarily an expert on
British dialects.
On you know, UK culture, but it comes across pretty clearly, and I enjoyed every minute of reading this book. This is honestly my book of the week.
Really?
I swear to God, I had a blast reading this. I am fascinated by it.
It's a lot of fun. It's taking that kind of war. It's like it's that kind of animal main character animal. Talking is hard.
Talking is hard. You should not ever do a radio show.
I know. I should never do radio. I'd be terrible at it.
Yeah.
But it matches up those two genres very well. It feels like I've read something like this before, but I can't actually think of anything like this.
Well, so. I think we've named a lot of things that are very similar. So I
like it, but not exactly like it.
No, and
it's interesting.
Yes, absolutely.
And I like the art. It's simple, but it works really well.
I think it's delightful. The only thing that kind of bugs me is the rabbit's fat neck.
Well, some rabbits do have fat necks.
I'm sure they do. It's probably, you know, I'm sure it's intentional. It just is really unnerving to look at.
And there's even like a little map at the end and a little fake newspaper.
That map, more than anything, makes me think of Winnie the Pooh. That's exactly what makes me think that's got to be a huge influence on this.
Well, they come out of the same kind of traditions. So.
No, absolutely.
Winnie the Pooh is just more, this is for adults, and not Winnie the Pooh is for children.
That's always what I thought Winnie the Pooh needed, is a lot of violence.
Flamethrowers?
Mm-hmm. Even before the violence, I was completely on board. I was like,
yeah, exactly.
I want to know where this is going. I think I would have possibly gotten bored eventually. After maybe 6 or 7 issues, if it was just these characters interacting. But the fact that there is this sort of science fiction twist to it, I think it's really going to propel me through the story. I am terribly excited about this book.
So that's Wild's End number 1. We are a double buy.
Yeah. Wowzers.
Wowzers. Lastly, but not leastly, well, we'll see what Eric thinks. Annihilator, number 1, written by V. Grant Morrison, and art by Fraser Irving, Jerry K. Fleischer on letters. This, like, it's a Grant Morrison comic. It's actually not as bad as some Grant Morrison comics, the complexity, but it certainly delves into a lot of themes that he hit into a lot. Basically, like, an author basically author and the world he's created meeting,
mm-hmm.
which Grant Morrison has done more than once before.
I missed that it was Grant Morrison, but it all completely falls into place now that you mentioned that.
You mean read the front cover?
Well, here's the thing. I thought it was just because Fraser Irving, but
well,
good Lord, Grant Morrison.
It
feels so masturbatory. And I understand why, because, I don't know, he's so self-indulgent.
It is that, certainly. There is that in it. I still like it.
I don't
Fraser Irving's
hate it.
Art is so...
No, it's very good. It's very Richard Corbin in a lot of ways. And I don't remember if I ever had that sort of impression of him before, but it feels like almost overwhelmingly Corbin inspired in this issue. But I don't really come away from this really liking any of these characters or really too wowed by the ideas in the story. It just feels like almost like a rehash of what Morrison's already done.
I'm I'm a little surprised. I thought you'd like this.
I don't. I mean, I do not dislike it. And
especially the about the author and all that stuff. I don't. That is kind of meh. Mm-hmm. But I think the sizzle is this outer space world that's built on the edge of a black hole that drives mm-hmm. everyone insane and guys trying to fear. I that world meeting the real world, quote unquote. I think that's. I think it's skillfully. I mean, the art is. I love Fraser Irving. And this mad scientist black hole guy who's, you know, space meeting his creator, quote unquote.
Mm-hmm.
Not the fact that it's been done, sure, but I'm still interested. I'm definitely going to be picking this up from now on.
I think it's just kind of a pretentious mess.
It's pretentious almost for certain.
Yeah.
But I would say it's not that messy.
It feels kind of like a hot mess to me. I mean, saying all of that does not mean that I dislike it. It's not a bad, bad, bad book, but it's a little bit of a pretentious mess.
I have a theory on you, Eric.
Let me hear it.
I figured
this theorizing. Out. Let's hear it.
I figured this out about you.
Oh, okay. I can't wait to be analyzed here.
No, it just dawned on me. Like, I'm trying to, like, think about, like, because that's really what I do every week. I pick out these books, and I read a book, and I go, I wonder if Eric's going to like this. And then I'm proven wrong or I'm proven right. And generally, I figured out what you like most in your comics. Maybe in all your art. I'm not sure about in art in general, but specifically in comics. That you like comics that are what they are. Like, they own what they are.
Hmm.
And if you don't like pretension at all.
It
unless
does...
it's the most super artistic thing ever. Unless someone's so talented that it doesn't matter.
Right.
But there's... generally, if something's pretentious, you don't like it very much.
And there's truth to that, but I think most people are this way, that pretentiousness is masking... It's sort of the opposite of honesty. And I like honesty in artwork. That's astute, but I think a lot of people... are like this. I think that most people are kind of clamoring for honesty in artwork. Whether it's writing or painting, drawing, comic books, whatever.
Yeah, it's true.
But I think your assessment on that is pretty true.
But I'm a buy on Annihilator number one. Are you a buy, Eric? That's your
that is
I, your,
that
feels
is
like
a
you're
really
teetering.
I kind of am, but there's value to this, despite all my criticisms, and I think it could be really tremendous. And there are a lot of ideas that are really fun. I just kind of want to slap Grant Morrison in his face after reading it. So, buy this book.
Oh, okay. Double, there we go.
Yeah, yeah.
Double buy in Annihilator number one. So that's a double buy on all three number ones.
Uh-huh.
Many books.
I think the only thing we disagreed on was Captain Marvel.
Because of your cold, cold heart.
Well, what can I say?
Yeah, folks, that's it for Week of Floppies. I did not read any other books this week. But anyway, we are moving on to our last segment of the week. It is Nerd Boy Book Club. This segment where Eric and I assign a longer collected work, we read it and discuss it. Generally more in depth than our typical comic book talk, generally. This week we are reading The Wrenchies by Farrell Dalrymple. He's most famously known for, he drew Omega the Unknown Limited series for Marvel. That's where I know him from. He's also done some other work by himself.
He's also a little orange man that rolled a blueberry kid.
He's not an Oompa Loompa. I've seen video of him. He's not an Oompa Loompa.
Okay.
He did not roll a blueberry girl into the laboratory or whatever.
Did he pull the fat kid out of the chocolate river?
The fat kid got sunk further down. He got sucked down a tube, didn't he? In the chocolate river?
I have no idea.
Followed by his father?
What do I look like I own a chocolate factory? I don't know these things.
No, and you look like a Marine. Oorah, oorah, oorah.
Okay, well, thank you.
Okay, where do you want to start with this book, Eric? We briefly touched on it last night in a phone conversation where we were both roughly the same place, about halfway through.
Yes.
I was right before the point where it made a sudden turn, again.
I don't know if I would even...
Hollis.
I don't know that
Hollis
I would...
came into it.
Right. I don't know that I would really describe any part of this as having a sudden turn, because it is a completely irrational storytelling.
Right.
The thing that this reminds me the most of, and I don't know that the example that we've done for book club, but it is the only thing that we have done by this author for book club, but I would say Mad Woman of the Sacred Heart, because it's very much that sort of Mobius style of storytelling, to where it's stream of consciousness writing, almost... I mean, done by an artist as an excuse to make art and do sequential storytelling, and not written by a writer for the sake of the craft of writing and telling a good story. I don't think it's particularly bad, but it's also a little bit more like watching someone else's dreams, which is why the story changes so radically and everyone just sort of goes along with it. And like, yeah, that is exactly what needed to happen this whole time. Of course, all these people are going to fall into our reality and travel through time. And of course that's going to happen. That makes perfect sense. And now these people are dead and everyone's just going to keep walking.
At least at a certain point, like, there's a goal.
Yes.
I think that's when I went, okay, I know where they're going.
Yes.
They're just not wandering.
Yeah. Which is
through the story.
Exactly. And that's the way a lot of these Mobius type stories, or even the Jodorowsky stories, that's sort of where they fail, is there is zero end game planned. And I think that's where this is more successful. You do get a sense of where it's going, but it does sort of, it takes a meandering way to get there. You want to give us a sort of bird's eye view of the story on this?
As much as I can.
It's a little messy.
It's meandering. I don't know how, trying to define it in a way of like storytelling is, I think, going to be difficult, because I don't know
yes.
how much of it was actually intentioned. Like you said, it's him giving him, like, here, I'm just drawing, you know, I want to draw art, and
mm-hmm.
here's a story that matches it. But the wrenchies are multiple things in this.
Yes.
At the base surface level, they're this gang of kids in this kind of post-apocalyptic wasteland. There's these evil creatures that look like businessmen from, like, the 50s.
Yeah.
That are monsters. There's also various other mutants and all kinds of weird stuff that attacks them, but they're just kind of trying to survive. After a child hits puberty, they're harvested by these creatures who use them to reproduce. That you don't really find a lot of this stuff out until they're the end of the book. A lot of the initial storyline is just these children either fighting monsters or just kind of hanging around, taking drugs or listening to music.
Kids on drugs, isn't that what everyone wants?
Yeah, we meet a kid in the current day named Hollis, who is dressed like a superhero. He is clearly not, like, he is, I don't know, some kind of personality disorder, or just a weird dorky kid.
He's just a nerd.
It's hard to say. I was a nerd too. I never dressed up like a superhero and walked around in the street like it.
He's Martin Prince, except maybe a little bit worse.
Yeah, and we meet him. There's his neighbor is this figure that, like, this basically wrote a comic book called The Wrenchies, which the kids in this future take their name from this comic book.
Mm-hmm.
The characters in the comic book end up being wrenched through space, and they're like, they were real people who were changed through the power of art into superheroes or adventurers, and they're wrenched into the Wrenchies time period.
Yes.
Like, in the future, to fight the artist who created all this, who is now the engine that powers the evil.
Makes perfect sense, right?
Yeah, that's as clearly as I can explain the plot.
I think you've done a masterful job, honestly. It is a weird story, and it's very messy. And I think it really is. It's a comic book done by someone that is not particularly trained in storytelling. From my understanding of Dalrymple's background, he's even sort of he's not even highly trained as an artist. He just has a lot of illustrative skill, and I think he's sort of an art school dropout based on the interview that I read of him. Maybe I'm wrong on that. Maybe he does have a degree, but it is sort of unfocused and strange, and it's a lot of ideas that he's had over his career of doing these different comics and different art projects and being a professional illustrator. Like, he said that he's got something like 300 pages of sketchbooks based just on this comic. It's just all apocrypha and stuff that he just, when he couldn't sit down and make himself work on the comic, he would do sketchbooks and try and create all this stuff. And it sort of has that feel of, well, here's this idea I have and these other three ideas that I thought up. And then, oh, here's this other idea and I'm going to converge them all. And it sort of doesn't work very neatly. It sort of tells a strange story.
Yeah, it's very strange.
Hollis in particular was a character that he was doing other comics about, and he sort of modified him and brought him into this story. I'm really sort of curious what he's trying to say with Hollis. You know, because... Go ahead.
I was going to say, there's a lot of... I think the weakest part about this is that because it tries to hit so many things, I think we even touched this on when we talked about Mad Woman of the Sacred Heart, where that because it tries to touch on a lot of different themes instead of just tackling one or two of them, you don't get the full effect of what he's maybe trying to say about them.
Yeah.
I know I've caught it just with a kind of a simple read through. You catch obviously there's themes there's that one like pimply kid who draws.
Mm-hmm.
Like he talks a lot about kind of art perspective with that kid. There's a lot of with Hollis, his mother is religious, and then you find that the main artist character who creates the Wrenchy's comic book, he also had a heavily religious mother, and there's kind of how that is. You see Hollis struggling with that a lot, like wanting to be a good person and worried that he's not. And I think a lot of that is, you know, powered by religious guilt.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of it, and I think there's even a little bit of a questioning of what this comic is. Like
sort of
some kind of subtextual exploration of what am I doing with this comic? What am I doing with art?
It's, you get that a lot in the end, especially. Sort of, right, sort of as a metafiction.
Yeah.
Sort of. Yeah, I understand where you're coming from there.
Because the quote unquote evil guy is a comic book creator, and he's a
comic book creator that created the comic book that's inside this comic book.
Yes, but he talks about why am I doing this? Why does it? There's a couple times they say, "Well, why did you choose a comic book? It takes so long to do."
Yes,
this book took him 5 years to make, there's. His girlfriend in the book is telling him, you know, you're not, which I think at that point she's just like a hallucination almost. She's a vision.
Yes.
She's not even real.
Well, it's not even clear if she was ever real. That's, yeah. they dance around that. Like, oh, am I real? Am I not? You know, we're not going to say.
No. And like, she's even like, why you're never going to be leaving this room if you want to make this book. You're just going to be here forever by yourself. Those are the main themes of this. I even caught, again, in that near the end section, where it's saying that, yeah, like so many others, you are too obsessed with your own personal story, obsessed with your own pain. What a waste. Like, it seems like he's almost, like, denigrated comics that are too serious, or just art that's too serious, that's not just kind of fun. But it's hard to say, because again, there's a lot, none of this is super focused, or even kind of focused. Like, here's that pimply kid who lives underground with this scientist character.
Yes.
He's a painter. He paints little pictures for all the kids. And, he has kind of a soliloquy about his art. Yeah, one of the kids goes, how do you know so much about stuff? Well, my way is all about perfecting my personal system, figuring out all the little things that work and don't work for you as a scholar or artist, whatever. 1,000 nuances, subtle adjustments all go into it. I am naturally gifted, of course, or at least I believe that I am, which is probably what really matters anyway. I use my intelligence to see how I can perfect a craft. My belief in myself as an artistic genius tempered with a calculating mind all help me a heck of a lot. Craft, for me, is a byproduct of working constantly in a specific manner. In most cases, I think that helps me express my ideas effectively. But speaking of efficiency in regards to art is tricky. Sometimes a drawing of an unskilled child can have more resonance.
Yeah, it's anything. It's borderline an artist's manifesto there.
Yeah.
It's clearly that's someone that's worked as an artist speaking directly through this character.
Yeah, I know. That's it. A lot of this book it seems to be about art, not necessarily the story specifically.
And I think I can kind of relate to that whole scene. That I am this same, and maybe this is just sort of common amongst us artist pseudo intellectuals.
Right.
That we have these kind of thoughts and think these sort of things about ourselves. And I know I am apt to give a soliloquy, something like this, and people kind of look at you like that. So then you turn around and like, oh, here's a drawing of a kitty. Which is exactly what happens here.
Yeah. Ooh boy, sorry guys, I am babbling.
Yep.
And they see the picture of a cat. Ooh, cool.
Yeah.
Speaking of, what do you think of his art style, Eric?
I like it considerably better like this than, because I pulled out the one trade paperback I have of Prophet. I think everything else is on my iPad, and I didn't want to look at it that way for whatever odd reason. But the first trade, issue 4 of Prophet, Brandon Graham's Prophet.
Rob Liefeld's Brandon Graham's Prophet.
Yes. I think we need to get more people doing this so it can be like Warren Ellis's Alan Moore's Brandon Graham's Rob Liefeld's Prophet.
Yes.
It can be that.
Yeah.
And then blood shoots out of my nose. I looked at issue 4 of Prophet, Brandon Graham's Prophet. And it looks kind of awful. Like, I thought the art was really ugly and naive, but that was because Farrell was not handling the art all the way through, that it was done in a sort of team fashion. And I think that when he's doing these grubby-looking pencils with all the smudge marks, and then he's doing his watercolors on top of them, and or digital color, I do not remember his process, but it seems like he's more traditional media minded. I know he doesn't like to necessarily draw in Photoshop, and I think he only does some cleanup and correction in Photoshop, and that's sort of the beginning and end of it. But here it's much stronger. Having someone come back behind him and clean it up and sort of crudely go over there's even something a little bit naive in the drawing of some of the characters. Like, it's a little bit crude. It's a little bit drawn a little bit wrong in some places, but it just sort of stylistically works. when all the pieces fall together. When someone else is assembling that, it doesn't look quite right. It just looks just badly done. This is, I think, the way his comics are supposed to look. With this sort of muddy color, it does seem to slant a little bit to the PP color range, which I don't particularly like, and it gets a little bit muddy, but it works fairly well and tells a pretty interesting story, and it's a unique look. You know, it's a unique style, unique way to tell a story. That I think is really what makes the Wrenchies worth looking through.
Yeah, it's. I don't. There's a large part of this book I had no idea what was happening.
That it's 90%+
but
of the story.
It still was interesting. I still exactly. I was still going, well, that's interesting.
Exactly.
The choices he makes are interesting, and they had me, you know, question certain things once in a while about what he's trying to do, what the story he's trying to tell is. And a lot of it has nothing to do with the actual story, I suppose. I read through a lot of, like, kind of people's reviews of the book, or at least earlier reviews, and there's a lot of complaints about the actual... You actually have the physical book, right? I don't think it's available digitally yet.
It is not, which is one of the reasons I was really stressed out, that I didn't think I would get it in time to read it. Because FedEx lost my copy, and I had to go hound them about it. They would not deliver it to my door.
What do you think about the book's format? It's not a typical comic book-sized book. It's similar...
It's kind of like a pocket manga, but a little bit larger.
Yeah.
It's about the size of... It's about the size of Seconds.
Yeah. I would say it's close to that size.
Roughly the length and... about the same dimensions.
There's some people complaining that his art, you can't catch all the details because it's too small.
Mm.
And that they didn't... I don't have any problem with the printing. I thought it looks pretty good.
No, I think the printing is actually very rich, and this is very challenging artwork, in my opinion, to print well. So I think their printers are really on point. They're clearly working very hard, really in every stage of this. And I do think that this would probably have been of better volume if it was like a full size, like, you know, maybe a 90% of the illustration board,
mm-hmm.
You know, if it was more of an artist edition version of this, I think it would have been probably better for the story. But Dalrymple is still a fairly unknown illustrator. I mean, he's really getting some clout for this and, you know, his work and profit. But he's not a big name. Except in tight circles. So I don't think it would have been a good move for them to try and sell like a $70 artist edition of this.
Right.
That's twice the, you know, twice the dimensions, you know, more than twice the square area, you know, just an enormous book to be true size of the art. And really allow you to look deeply on this. I think it works just fine at this size. I think the people on Amazon just need to get their prescription checked.
Yeah, I don't. Some people just I think in equal measure there are people complaining about the lack of cohesion versus the like some I like people loved it or hated it.
Well, it's not It's not a book by a professional writer. It is a book drawn by a professional drawer.
I think it's there was one person put their summary of the book as this, of the plot summary. It was, a fat, nerdy kid saves the world from his neighbor's inner demons.
Yeah.
And I think that's about as succinct as you can get it without it completely losing what the book is about. But
I think really any of the three segments, you know, the three sort of groups of characters
mm-hmm.
that this is about could have been a very good story in and of themselves. Like, I think if you told stories about the brothers,
right,
that could have worked very well. If you just told stories about these weird kids in a post-apocalyptic future fighting monsters,
mm-hmm.
that could have worked. And if you told stories about Hollis and whatever, I mean, I think he's probably the weakest. There's like the least meat there. But it's still compelling because you're like, why is he dressed like this? Why does he act this way? And you kind of want to find out more. It really is kind of a strange mashup that they're all brought together and told this way. And it comes together, but I think at the cost of three stronger stories.
Yeah, it's hard to say. I actually most compelled by the Sherwood story, the comic book artist I think that
Sherwood and his brother.
Yeah, Sherwood and his brother, who he never finds.
He shoots him in the head.
No, that's not his brother.
Yeah, that is his brother, Orson.
That's not his brother. That's the guy he hangs around because he looks like his brother.
Okay, well, I missed that. What was his name?
I don't even know. I don't think they even, do they even say his name? It's basically just a druggy kid that he at one point says, yeah, I
remind him of Orson, he told me so.
Yeah, exactly. But I think his story is the most compelling to me, although all these stories, like you said, they could be individually very strong if told separately.
See, that's a really strange, I don't know, that's a strange decision to make. There's a lot of really strange decisions in this book.
Yeah, and those are, I think, what made it a lot very interesting to a certain extent, like why he did certain things, the choices he made.
Well, a lot of it, I don't think, is grounded in any sort of logic or any storytelling craftsmanship. It's
just, I paint what I want or I draw what I want.
Yeah. Very much so. That it's taking a lot of existing ideas and putting them together. The thing about this book, reading his interview, is it seems like he could have made it go on considerably longer, when in fact I think he could have made it more impactful, made it half this length, tightened it up a lot, and gone with it. I think that this sort of shows something that's wrong with indie comics, you know, where the creator is making all the decisions, and while I do think that there is good in that, it is good to listen to peers and editors and other people's feedback. Yeah. I feel a lot of creator-owned stuff. Like, I think that a comic that is as universally lauded as Pretty Deadly.
Right.
When I don't remember if you were there for that panel or not, but you probably were, when Kelly Sue was talking about how her editor said, well, this is kind of messy and kind of confusing and kind of this and kind of that. And she's like, well, fuck you. It's creator owned. I'm making it. I call the shots. And she put it out exactly the way she wrote it. And I think much to the detriment, I thought that it was a little bit messy and a little bit confusing and could have bettered from some editing and some revising. I mean, that's my opinion. Obviously, it was one of the biggest indie books of the year. So who the fuck am I to tell her what to do? But I still think that indie books suffer from that.
Do you think that he's even addressing that in this book with that one of those epilogues where he's, you know, where I read mm-hmm. already, where he's talking about I was obsessed with my own personal problems, et cetera, et cetera. Do you think he's in even kind of addressing that in the text about how that sometimes he's the tendency to, I don't know, obsess over certain things instead of just telling a simple story? Do you think that's what he's saying?
Maybe? I don't know. It's possible you could read into it that way.
Yeah. But it's not, it's hard to say.
Mm-hmm. I mean, it's a very common thing, that sort of egocentrism.
Right.
I was just reading about it in You Are Not So Smart, how everyone does it, and everyone thinks that they're the center of attention, and everyone is, you know, pointing a spotlight at all your faults and all the horrible things, and you think you're, you know, so noticeable, and no one even bats an eye at you. But I'm not quite sure what he's saying, but I don't think that's an unreasonable thing to think.
No, there, I would say there's one other theme that we haven't touched on, was kind of an anti-corporatism, because he goes to work for the government.
Yes.
Sherwood character, and the evil monsters are dressed up in suits and ties.
There's a strong theme of this, particularly in the first section about the kid Grinchies, about the fear of getting older, the fear of growing up, the fear of quote unquote selling out.
Right.
The monsters are, you know, like you said, they're businessmen, they're adults, and when the teenagers get so old, they're harvested and become monstrous adults. You know, this is what we talked about how the whole first part of this book is it's Akira plus Peter Pan. It's the Never Never Land story, except really, really grisly, with kids taking drugs.
Yeah. Goonies as well.
Goonies. Yeah, that's good.
His thoughts are consumed with violence and irritation towards all the problems he sees around him. He perceives himself as a victim of an imposed value system based on rampant consumerism.
Mm-hmm. That's talking about Sherwood again.
Yeah. And that's kind of a lot of him is, as he's 30, like he has all these adventures and then he turns 35 and he suddenly gets a grown-up job. Quote unquote.
Now, there's a lot of themes of freedom, you know, the whole idea of Sherwood makes me think of, you know, Sherwood Forest, Robin Hood, sort of living this outlaw life. And I think that's, I don't know, as an artist, I think that's probably how he sees himself, you know, Dalrymple does.
Yeah.
If that makes sense, you know, he's not doing the 9-to-5 and selling out. I don't know, maybe there's a lot of, it does feel pretty personal, you know, it's sort of a meditation on how he feels, like, you know, maybe he hasn't made it, you know, maybe it's not, like, he's nervous about this artist's life, like, he's not a particularly successful indie artist, he feels like the most mainstream thing he's done is this incredibly weird book with Brandon Graham, and he feels like he's selling out to do that.
Well, I don't think that's something you see with Brandon Graham himself.
Mm-hmm.
I often question why the antagonism towards, you know, mainstream, quote unquote,
right,
or corporate work at Marvel or DC and stuff like that.
I know Brandon's pretty openly antagonistic about it.
Yes, he is.
He's not a big fan of neither Marvel nor DC, which I still have not listened to those interviews with him interviewing Kelly Sue and Matt Fraction.
Yeah, which they're very good, but I don't know. We're kind of getting off topic.
I think it's related. I mean, they're all, it's sort of one big family. I mean, he is he's a collaborator of Dalrymple's. So yeah, I think it's relevant discussion.
I just don't understand the kind of why. Yes, I understand that Marvel and DC are, they tell superhero stories and not very much else, but I don't see the why to be, because there's an editor who wants you to do things a certain way with books they're putting out, they're managing their characters.
I think that, and I'm bringing up You're Not So Smart again, because there's a section where they talked about the whole idea of counterculture and how so many people from our generation, we sort of try and establish our identities and one-up each other by having sort of our own unique indie tastes. And like, well, I'm into this very artistic and interesting thing, and that makes me artistic and interesting. And I think going along with that, being the sort of counterculture, iconoclastic creator, the way Brandon Graham sort of sees himself, and probably Dalrymple as well, that all they can do is that they buck against the establishment, and in comics, that's Marvel and DC. So, you know, if you define yourself as necessarily against it, I mean, you'll really have to write yourself a lie. You know, you'll really have to figure out some bullshit to tell yourself if you're ever going to accept it. Does that make sense?
Yeah, I understand. I know a lot of it roots into how they treat their employees.
Oh, of course.
Yeah, and comic books are not lucrative.
Not as much as, you know, you would like to think. They don't sell hundreds of thousands of copies.
The top-selling comic book,
yes,
a month might sell 100,000.
Yes.
Might.
And that's
one comic, not 50 comics.
Yeah.
It's not 1993. You're not selling 10 million comics anymore.
What was it? Kelly Sue said that Pretty Deadly sold 60,000 copies, and she said that she almost vomited. She was so excited about it selling 60,000 copies.
Yeah.
All book sales are really quite low.
Yeah.
Quite low.
Written work. Yeah,
yes.
Not just comic books.
New York Times bestsellers will sell like what, 20 to 60,000 copies?
Yeah, somewhere in there. I read 30,000.
Yeah, I don't like the sales are never very outrageous. They'll sell like 20,000 copies, and that is by that standard, a wildly successful book.
Yes. So I don't. There's just not. It's hard to be an artist.
It is.
And survive just doing that.
Well, there's fucking zillions of us.
Yeah.
There are many, 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 many artists.
And that's just a story we're getting reinforced in pretty much every kind of art medium.
Mm.
That there's going to be very few who make a good living at it, and then most everyone else is going to struggle or fail just because of the way our culture is heading, where how dissemination of art has made it so many niches that, you know, there used to be 3 channels on TV, and now there's 1,000. You know, now there's the internet, which is a million channels.
Mm.
So you're not, regardless of what you're creating.
I think there's even more than 1,000 channels. I think that's just, you know, that's just rhetorical. That's just rhetorical. I understand.
Yeah. But I guess it is the resistance to selling out, mm-hmm. I suppose, about being you at all times and never doing something just for money.
Yeah.
Which, I mean, I don't know.
I think there's value to that thought, but at the same time, I don't think there's there's no shame in doing something that is good, or listening to an editor, or crafting something that more people can enjoy. And I think this could have benefited from some of that. Not everyone is somehow amazingly gifted like Paul Pope and can just have Battling Boy fall out of his butt somehow. I have no idea what his editorial process was like. Maybe he showed it to 1,000 different people and asked them all their opinions and wrote and rewrote.
But do you think that would it lose some of its personality?
I think that he could have adequate personality coming across. It could still be a very honest work. This very much feels like a draft of something to me. Like I feel like there's clearly a lot of smarts and talent here. And it's obviously something he's put tremendous work into. But in the end, he's an artist telling a story. As opposed to when I read Battling Boy, it's all seamless. It's a well-told story about intriguing and interesting characters drawn by someone who is a top-notch artist at the top of his game. This is a lot like a Mobius comic in that it feels very aimless and dreamlike.
But I mean, Mobius. We talk about indie artists. Mobius was very much.
Oh yeah.
That, you know, he did very little mainstream work.
No, I understand. Well, he did not do a lot of Marvel and DC work. No.
No.
But.
He's very influential in people who did mainstream work and stuff like that. He did work on movies and things like that. But I mean, like, of his comic book work, like, if you ask a comic book reader today, how many people know who Mobius is?
Well, when you talk about an average person, I'm sure next to none, but he's always been the artist's artist anyway.
That's what I mean. And I think that's kind of the ideal.
Mm-hmm.
I know Brandon Graham idolizes Mobius, and I'm assuming that most artists do.
Well, and I'm positive that, I mean, Dalrymple mentioned Mobius specifically in the interview that I read of him. So, I mean, it's clear he knows who he is. And
yeah, yeah.
He's drawn to that sort of writing style. Anyway, what you were saying?
No, I'm just saying that I think that that's, I mean, they idolize him and they see someone who never compromised his artistic vision, even if it was to his own detriment.
And that is just sort of where I differ, that I think that telling as strong a story as possible, that's sort of killing your darlings and sacrificing some small things that you find honest. I think that's a small price to pay to tell a story that would be tighter and better for most people. I mean, of course, where do you draw that line? You know, when do you stop making the kind of art that really you set out to make and you're just making pop art for mass consumption? Where does that end? It's a very squishy sort of line. You don't know when you've crossed it until you're way past it. And maybe you're just so afraid of that that you never step away from making art that looks like this.
Would you recommend this?
To a lot of people, but not to anyone that isn't an artist or someone that likes... They would have to like indie comics. The same people that I would recommend Mobius to. The same people that I would recommend Prophet to. I think there's already this sort of... this underground comics reader.
Right.
I would recommend this to them. I would not recommend this as... Maybe to a person that dips their toe into comics and does not like superhero comics. This would be an example of, here's something that's not a superhero comic. Here's something that's a little weird and interesting. But that person would have to define themselves as, oh, well, I read things that are weird and interesting.
Right. I think I agree with you.
But most people, I would be recommending lots of other things that we read over this. But it is, it's by no means bad. I think that it's just...
No, I enjoyed it.
Yeah. No, I did too. It's just, as a storyteller, he leaves some things to be desired. As an artist, I think he is a very fabulous and clever illustrator. And I think even his muddiness and imperfections add to the honesty and the beauty of this work.
Yeah, I agree. So, folks, next week for Nerdboy Book Club, we are doing Andre the Giant, Life and Legend by Box Brown, a biographical comic book about Andre the Giant, one of the best professional wrestlers of all time.
What was Andre's last name? I know you know this.
Rusimov.
Rusimov. That sounds very Russian for a Frenchman.
Yeah, I think he was a kind of mongrel.
He was.
Yeah.
Like
myself.
I gotta mash up a lot of DNA to get a 7 foot tall man.
Yeah. But he was larger than life in stature and in personality. It's a great book, so I am looking forward to discuss it.
We're gonna read that book and drink 42 beers in his honor.
More than 42.
I bet he would rank more than 42. Actually, wasn't it like 100 or something? Like something like in the 90s?
They cover it in the book, and we'll discuss it.
I can't wait. He's such a fascinating guy.
Yeah. So next week is Andre the Giant by Box Brown. I think that will bring us to a close, however. We are the Handsome Boys Comics Hour. You can find us at handsomeboyscomicshour.com. You can find us on iTunes and Stitcher Radio. Search for us there. Please review, subscribe, rate us there. It really helps out. You can find us on Facebook, facebook.com/handsomeboyscomicshour. We are on Twitter at HBC Hour. You can find me on Twitter at MixmasterCereal, MixmasterCereal. See all the things they get up to online. Eric, where can they find you? And your things online.
I'm going to plug my things.
Plug them.
You can see my portfolio by going to freewillunlimited.com. And you can, in addition to that, see most of the things I do online by going to ericzgoodnight.com. And you can send me tweets. My Twitter handle is Mr. Bad Example, spelled MR Bad Example.
So, folks, until next time, have a good one.
Rock and roll.